Tonight, by the grace of God, I wanted to speak about something I believe ought to be said, something that has been left like a dead corner sitting between the great feasts, that is, the Nativity of our Lord, His baptism, and the beginning of His public ministry. Because I don't know if you've noticed, there are many texts of the Church that refer to days on which we don't attend church, whether because of our work or because there isn't a liturgy in every neighborhood days that would help us keep in mind the continuity of things. What I want to bring to the surface tonight, because it carries a moral lesson, is what are called the temptations of the Lord, when He too, as a man, was tempted by Satan. And a person needs to know this, because at the same time, it is a comfort. And he says, if a God was tempted, will I, a sinner, not be tempted? And since He was tempted and won the victory, and I am tempted in almost the same way, how did He conquer? If only I knew the method, so that I too could conquer. This is an event recounted only by the two evangelists, Matthew and Luke, in the 4th chapter. Apart from small details, they recount roughly the same thing, as if one had copied the other. The temptations of the Lord took place right after His baptism. If you read the texts, and specifically the evangelist Matthew, for instance, you will see that after the baptism, right where it records what was spoken from heaven about our Christ, as He is baptized, and specifically the words, a voice from heaven saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." Then immediately afterward, as the chapter changes and the fourth comes onto the scene, it says this, "Then Jesus was led up into the wilderness by the Spirit, to be tempted by the devil. The Spirit took the man Jesus and led him into the wilderness, and there he was tempted, that is, so to speak, to sit in examination before Satan." Strange things, of course, to many people who have not gone deeply into these matters and do not know them, have not paid attention. So this event has great importance. That is exactly why I thought tonight to bring it to your attention, even though the hour will not be enough for us, because we cannot manage to unfold this subject in a single hour. It will surely need a second hour as well, and if God permits, we will speak next Thursday about whatever is left from tonight. So Jesus was led, it says, into the wilderness by the Spirit, to be tempted by the devil. As for the wilderness, those who have been counted worthy and have gone there know that it is the wilderness of the Jordan, the upper part of Jericho, the mountain there, the one called Sarantarian, which took its name because it was there that our Lord remained the 40 days and was tempted by Satan, and indeed fasting and praying. That is how it has this name. One will know exactly the place where he prayed, because his imprints are there below, and this stone on which he evidently leaned, praying on his knees, has the fragrance we spoke of a little earlier in the introduction. The fragrance of the all-holy tomb, of the ascension, of the transfiguration, of all those places our Christ passed through and trod upon, where the deposition from the cross took place, where the precious cross stood, all these places have the same fragrance. And this rock where our Christ evidently prayed, kneeling and leaning there, has this very same fragrance. Now, the one who is going to conduct his examination, rather, is Satan. A person needs to know, based on this teaching that flows from here, that he has three enemies, three principal enemies. We could set them on equal footing, and if we imagine placing before us not one, then two, then three, but side by side, then still, even though they are equal, we could mark them A, B, and C, and we would find that man's first enemy is his own flesh. And we would find that man's first enemy is his own flesh. The second is the world, and the third is Satan. Many, not knowing themselves, not knowing their flesh, treat it as a friend, when in fact it is an enemy. The world they reckon with, they take it into account. They hold it as a friend, and cannot do without the world. Many times, indeed, even to the harm of their own soul, they take the world's side. Many times they serve an eviction notice on Christ, on the Theotokos, and on the saints, so as not to spoil the world's pleasure, because the world wants it that way, the clothing, the food, and I don't know how many other things the world serves up. This too is to be taken into account, and it is this that a person ought to concern himself with. And third in order comes Satan. That, after all, is how our Christ was tempted. That is how, by his own deeds, he showed that man must defend himself. Against the flesh, he used fasting. Because, I don't know, perhaps you have read it and now you're hearing it again in repetition, but you must have noticed this. And having fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he was afterward hungry after 40 days. And since he was hungry, the tempter came to him and said, If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. So when Christ, it says, stopped fasting, he grew hungry, and then Satan goes to him and says, If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. He did not say to him, Since you are hungry, seeing that you are hungry, why should you go hungry? If you are the Son of God, he said to him, the question is a trap. But Satan always speaks in a way meant to mislead. Never place any trust in him. He is trying to discover something that up to that hour he had not been able to establish, and he does it by this means. What is it? You know, listen then to what it is. At the baptism he was present, he saw the heavens opened and the Spirit descending upon him. At the same time he heard the voice of Sabaoth, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. So this is the one. Well, we'll see whether it is really him. He holds that in reserve and keeps watch on him now. Now Christ leaves and goes into the wilderness, and he prays and fasts 40 days and 40 nights. Not just 40 days, 40 days and 40 nights. Because we may fast for 40 days, but in the evening we eat it all, and so we are not really fasting. He fasted both night and day. That kind of fast is different. Moses kept such a fast, and the prophet Elijah kept such a fast as well. There are others besides our Jesus who fasted 40 days. So now he watches him praying and fasting. Truly this is the Son of God. So why does he fast, and why does he pray? What is he afraid of, if he really is the Son of God? Right there the devil loses his bearings. He cannot confirm it 100%. Because at the baptism he did indeed hear and see things beyond his own powers. But here he sees him as a complete man, worn down and the rest of it. What happens now? Is it him or isn't it? That is his question. Could it be that the Lord had fallen ill and was told to eat because he is weak and suffering? His question was exactly what he voiced. If you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. And from that he thinks, I will now find out, and I will keep watch on you and act accordingly. Because, you know, our Christ kept the devil guessing, one moment hitting the nail, the next hitting the horseshoe. He sees him open tombs, though he did not open Lazarus's tomb himself, yet he also sees and hears him ask at the same time, Where have you laid Lazarus? He sees him weeping outside Lazarus's tomb, but God weeping that he cannot grasp. He sees him elsewhere asleep, but God asleep? Elsewhere he walks upon the sea, that is God. And so the contradictions piled up, and in this way Christ kept him confused all the way to Golgotha. The devil's greatest delusion was when he heard our Christ on Holy Thursday evening praying there, Say, let this cup pass from me. There, the resolve, as if to say, if you think it right, if you can see a way, let them avoid it. Right there he concluded plainly that this cannot be God. For if he were God, why would he fear the cross? Gods are not crucified. He could never grasp that God had become man, because his reasoning ran only one way, upward. That the God who was above should come down below, this he found impossible. On the whole, he cannot understand the Christian way. And today, too, among us, proud people cannot understand Christianity. I don't understand why you fast, why you pray, how you think that you would give someone the benefit of the doubt and say to him, Go, I don't hold it against you, and so on. These things are foreign to such people. Here he says to you, Everyone takes, and you, why do you give? Everyone steals, and you tell me that you don't want to steal? That's just how life is, he says. He cannot understand these things. This very thing happened to Satan as well. That is why he even dared to have him raised up on the cross. And then all those same signs that were taking place, tombs opening, the dead being shaken loose, the sun hiding its rays. So many things happen. He realized he had been trapped. He stirs people up and they shout at him, "Come down." "I will come down now. Here where you have put me, I will not come down." Back in paradise, he seized man, setting him a trap, telling him that he would become God. He cast him a hook, and on that hook he had baited godhood. "When you swallow this hook, you will become God." And you know that man did not become God, and so he swallowed it. Now Christ in turn baits the hook with a small fish, with a man, and Satan devours it as a man and meets God. He took hold of earth, he says, and encountered heaven, as John Chrysostom says in his catechetical homily. He did not expect this. The one who was seizing was himself seized and found himself standing before God. And now you understand what happened to Satan. These stratagems, these tactics, the believer must know. The man of God must know Satan's devices and what God did and how God proved by his own life before all people that if they do not want to, they do not fall into Satan's hands, and that they cannot blame God, saying that Satan made him do this and that. No, God did not make Satan what he is. He made him an angel. He fell on his own. He abandoned his own dwelling. Read the Epistle of Jude, just before Revelation, and you will see that he abandoned it on his own. He too was free, and he abandoned it on his own, and from white he became black. And today this black one God uses for the sanctification of the faithful. Without Satan, there are no saints. He is the touchstone on which man is tested. Men under testing, or else you are deceived and you blame Satan and God, and some go further back all the way to Adam and Eve, and curse them, saying they are to blame. They are to blame. "But I," says the Lord, "did you no harm? I helped you to be healed." After all, it was the Lord himself who took up this matter. He was crucified, and he says to you, "You, plunge into the water, be baptized in it, and be cleansed of this. And from there on we will have an account to settle between us. Because just as you fell in the first man, the tree of knowledge was a struggle. Shall I eat it? Shall I not eat it? Why did you forbid it to me?" And so on. In exactly the same way, after baptism, in every person a testing remains. It is that struggle. It is the tree of knowledge. Afterward, a testing comes upon man, toward his inclination, toward that place where man must struggle with God's help and with humility and rise above this thing. Doesn't it strike you that he went out into the wilderness to be tempted? Why did he go into the wilderness to be tempted? Because he is the new Adam. He stands in the place of the old Adam who sat for his examination. Was he in a city? Among people, there was no one. Was there anyone? He was alone. He was in a wilderness. Did he have any counselor? Did he have anyone to comfort him? No, he had no one, and he failed. So Christ goes into the place of the old Adam, into the wilderness, to have no one, and to take his examination there. And he proves that the first Adam, had he had humility and obedience, had no reason to fall, just as he himself did not fall. For our Christ did not struggle as God, he struggled as man. As God, he is unapproachable, he is not tempted by anyone, and he has no need of Satan at all. "You did not fast, I told you. Out of the 1,000 trees of the garden, use the 999, only do not use the one. Since you did not fast, I fast 40 days and 40 nights, to show you that you could have settled this matter which you failed to settle there. What the expulsions are, what the falls are, and for what cause, all the things the world talks about. And if Adam had fasted from the tree, we would not now be in need of this fasting," says St. Basil the Great. "So you did not fast, Adam, and you cast everyone out of the whole world, both yourself and your descendants, so I will fast to show them that you fell wrongly, not because I did not make you well, but because you would not obey." So he was carried away by his belly and did what he did. "I then will come into your very place, there where you fell, to rise up, to stand firm, and to prove to you that you are the guilty one. There is no excuse whatsoever. If man is willing, everything is provided for." But man, unfortunately, most people do not want to. That is, they simply do not want to. Except for a certain few, the rest, out of egoism, are convinced they have learned it all, that they have been wronged, and they sleep untroubled. But they will wake up in anxiety after death. And that anxiety cannot be healed. So there are many little things here surrounding this matter which are taught and to which we must pay attention. So Christ was tempted 40 days and 40 nights, fasting there, to show us too in what manner this fasting brings good fruit to man. A fasting which we Christians, for our part, do not keep as we ought to keep it, and some of us do not keep at all. There are many reasons by which a man can justify certain things, but in these cases he will not be able to justify himself, because they show plainly that man simply does not want to. If anyone reads John Chrysostom's commentary through in order, that is, there is his commentary on the Gospel of Matthew, whoever reads it there will find many things that help him, and so he will not be scandalized when he hears the things that are said about the person of our Christ. Allow me to read you his view on this. He says that he might bring Satan low, not by hunger alone, but also by the place. He gives him an occasion to take hold. I come into the wilderness, just the two of us, in the same way you took on that first one back then, whom I had formed, and you conquered him and put him to death. Here I am, I come myself. Come, let us talk it over. Tell me what you have to say to me. Do to me what you have to do. Because some people think they have been wrong because Adam fell. I don't know if you notice in baptism at one point, Christ says through the priest to the child, or to the adult who was baptized, he says to him, you were baptized, you were chrismated, you were justified. Well, you were baptized, I understand. Chrismated, that I understand. But you were justified. What business does that have in the middle here? What kind of word is that? I would have expected it to say he was justified, or take the one unjustly put to death. He was not there when his forefather Adam sinned. He bears no blame. Yet it is I who am crucified, I who die, and it is I who make him righteous. From here on, my fine fellow, the rest is up to you. The earlier debts are washed clean. We simply do not know the texts of our church. Thank you. You have to show what you yourself have done beyond this. As for the one who was baptized, we treat it as something cheap, a trivial matter, and we just go along to the baptism casually. This is a weighty mystery, and woe to the person who does not grasp it as he ought to grasp it. So John Chrysostom says here, not by hunger alone, but by the place as well. He gives the devil his opening. For the devil attacks most of all when he finds people already isolated and off on their own. Listen to how John Chrysostom has framed it. For the devil attacks most of all when he finds people already isolated and off on their own, alone and cut off from the rest. Ecclesiastes says, woe to the one who is alone, as though he had written it about the Pope. Woe to the one, on this point the church never trusts in a single man. And the opinion of any one man will have to pass through the seal of the synod. Whatever the councils ratify is received as God inspired. Even if a man is a saint and simply speaks on his own, it is not taken into account unless it has been approved by a council. Here, the Divine Father is hinting, as he goes on to say, further down, at the case of the first man. Consider how Satan worked back then. There were two of them, and he was one. Who were the two? Adam and Eve. Who is the one? Satan. How did Satan work? Not while the two of them were together. So he took care to become two himself, so that the two of them together could bring Adam down. And that is exactly what happened. He did not come when the two were together. He came when Eve was on her own, at the moment when he made himself into a second one alongside her. He and Eve came to an understanding, and now, with Eve as his helper, he throws Adam down. Man is made of flesh and of spirit. Man falls more easily when he is assailed from both sides at once, both the fleshly and the spiritual, if Satan had come only as a logismos, an intrusive thought, and merely suggested it, most likely he would not have achieved so much. As for Job's wife, Satan did not kill her. even though she too was within his jurisdiction. Why did he preserve her so that he could use her against Job the next day? And you remember his wife says, "Are you still holding fast to your integrity?" So the wife says, "What am I to do, husband, but tell you to curse God and die?" Now, if she told me to curse God and I would then be made well, that I could understand. But you can see that I'm going to die anyway, so why should I curse God? What do you imagine you would gain from it? It is not I who stand to gain. The one who stands to gain is the one at work inside me, the one who has laid a wager with God. You catch my meaning. So this holy man says here, in the same way he set upon the woman from the very beginning, that is, Eve, as I told you, catching her by herself and finding her apart from her husband, he found her without her husband and they became two, just as I am telling you, exactly as we read in Genesis. In Genesis 1:1, "For when people are already in the company of others and knit together, when they have companionship, two together they confer with one another, they pray together, they talk things over, one asks the other's opinion, and if he has no one else, he asks his elder, his spiritual father, someone more illumined, then the devil does not take courage in the same way, nor does he hope as he does when a man is alone, nor can he persuade, nor can he prevail. Therefore, above all, and for this very reason, keep company with one another." Companionship, he says, is good, spiritual companionship. Stay in constant relationship with one another, so that it is not easy for the devil in so many cases. When we have no one beside us to tell our pain to, it drives us all the way to suicide. Many people would have taken their own lives had God's providence not caught them at the very edge to let them hear a soothing word. You say, "Go get someone over there." What good will it do? Ah, but you're helping the man, right at the point where the other person is driving him to despair. Always. You do not need to go to the medium, to the fortune teller, nor anywhere else, nor to the witch, nor to any such place, nowhere at all. Christ resolves it so long as there is humility, faith, confession, and repentance. That is the whole point. You don't try in your own way to solve things that are humanly unsolvable. God will solve them. So when he says, when they are already together with others and knit closely, Satan does not take courage the way he did back then. He doesn't dare to try it. And so for this very reason, keep company with one another continually, so that it will not be easy for the devil. So that Satan cannot get his hands on you easily. I don't know whether you're aware, whether you read these things, but many holy people were led astray by Satan because they stayed on their own. They trusted their own judgment, they trusted themselves, and they were deceived. That is why the safest road, even for these men of the Spirit, is obedience. It is what we call the koinobitic life. It is not asceticism up on the mountain all by yourself. Such a man may indeed succeed, but he is in danger, 99%, 99%. When you are in a community under a spiritual father, the whole matter changes. They will notice your distress. The fathers will rush to help you. Your spiritual father will take you in hand. You will confess, and they will stand beside you right up to your death. Satan may well be preparing you to become a patriarch, only for you to end up hanged somewhere on a rock, or thrown into the sea by the devil. It is a fearful thing for a person to rest content in his own opinion, even if he is seeing miracles, even if he is seeing, I don't know what he is seeing. Because Satan, in order to bring a person to where he wants him, will allow him to meet with 999 miracles and truths, so that he can then serve him one of his own, for he is a craftsman. Do not put your trust in it. A person will always be safe if he is under the counsel of someone, and especially of a discerning, spiritual man. The prayer of the elder is a great thing. It shuts Satan up. He cannot speak. He cannot go forward. It is not for his mouth to speak. That is why he says here, he does not take courage in the same way. Satan does not find the boldness to attack. I don't know if you will remember something I told you one evening. I don't remember what we were talking about or how the subject came up. I told you of an incident that took place at Spada. At Spada, Every Saturday evening, a vigil is held. There was a demon-possessed man inside. The all-night service had not yet begun. And at one moment he broke out in glee. "Now you'll see he's coming. Now you'll see what I'll do to him. Now you'll see what I'll say to him. Who is it that is coming? A monk is coming." He was an Athenite monk who had come to Athens. "Now you'll see where he went today and what he did today," and so on and so on. You see, instead of praying and saying, "My Christ, do not allow him, whether it be true or false, to say anything about this man, because it will do harm," we were all set, waiting for him to come so we could hear it. So at one point there, they see down at the door that the monk is coming in. Satan is not everywhere present, but he has his informers. His little demons told him he's coming in from outside. So off he goes, he's coming to the door. They immediately opened a path for him, everyone, so he could get faster to the front before the demon-possessed man, so they could hear. The demon had the trap all planned. The man venerated the holy icons as he came in and moved on down toward the sanctuary there, since they had opened a way for him, and he found himself face to face with the demon-possessed man. The moment he came face to face and the demon-possessed man went to say something, the elder, the monk, sensed it, and he says this to him, "By the prayer of my elder, be silent." And silent he was, and not just frozen stiff for a while, frozen stiff right up until morning. "By the prayer of my elder." Do you understand what it meant for him to say that? What security it creates? My spiritual father told me this, because when you go to your spiritual father, it is as though you are going to God. He is so much God's instrument through whom he works. His own experience, of course, may not amount to I don't know how much. But for the present need, for that particular moment, this answer was enough to save you, without making an issue of rank. He then advances you, then he sends you on to others who are discerning, and so on. You humbled yourself, you set aside confidence in yourself, and you ask for another man's opinion. This is a great thing in the eyes of God. God will not let you go to ruin. The common people say in their own theology, a man who has no one to ask, asks his own walking stick. And there's another saying, when someone has no one to ask, he asks the wall. That is a great lesson. It is the egotist who rests on his own wisdom. Take the other person's view into account as well. You don't know what God may answer you even through him. Let him be however many steps below you. You're not doing it for the sake of his wisdom. You're doing it because you're given an opportunity, or rather you give an opportunity for Christ to speak to you through him. And many people have been saved this way. They have headed off many things. From this small experience of my 30 years of ministry, more than 100 cases have come back to my ears. People telling me, "We asked you, and you gave us this word. And I don't even remember the word, I don't remember the question, I don't remember the people, I don't remember what I said. If you ask me afterward what this one said to you and what you answered him, I confess before the Lord I don't remember yet." That person took the answer, acted on it, and was saved. So Christ went alone into the wilderness to show people that the first man in the wilderness, without any help, could have been saved with God back then. But Adam did not do this. And here we are in a better position today than they were. We are in a better position. And Chrysostom continues and says, "Therefore we ought especially, for this reason too, to gather continually with one another, so that we give no easy opening to the devil." We do not give the devil an opportunity, for not while fasting now he shows when Satan tempted the Lord. Not while fasting, but while hungering does he approach. Satan did not come near during the 40 days while Christ was fasting. When he ended the fast, then Satan approached and appeared as an angel of light and said, "If you are the Son of God, not if you are hungry, why sit here starving? But if you are the Son of God," because that was his whole aim, to find out whether he was the Son of God, so that he could take his measures. For he saw one thing at the baptism and sees another in the wilderness, and he is thrown off. He cannot work it out. And this Holy Father continues and says, "Not while fasting, but while hungering does he approach." that you may learn how great a good fasting is, what a good thing fasting is. When Satan sees you from afar, he throws temptations at you if you fast, to force you to break the fast, so that he can come and devour you. As long as you keep fasting, for this reason he cannot come at you, perhaps you don't quite grasp it. Something comes to my mind, and I should tell it to you. There was a demon-possessed man. The other brothers, since he was in their cell, took him around. There was nowhere they didn't take him. But no one could cast the demon out of him. At one point they took him to a man who truly had the power. But this man also had humility, and he had love. And they said to him, "Elder the brother, as you can see, you must pray for it to leave him." "I don't have such power," he says. "God did not give me this power to command the demon to come out, but I have love, and what I can do for the brother is to entreat the demon to leave him and come into me instead. If I set the brother free, let him too find rest after suffering so many years." And the demon comes out of the possessed man and goes into the elder. And it remains in the elder for 14 whole years. This struggler carried his cross and the torments that Satan put him through. One day, Satan comes out of him like a black dog and starts to leave. "Hey," the elder says to him, "where are you going? I'm not driving you out." "Sit as long as you like." "Yes, I'll stay," it says. "On a single date pit from a palm tree, I could live, sitting inside you." Now, the matter of fasting is another thing entirely. If someone would go not even far, just to Cephalonia, to hear how the demon speaks about those who fast voluntarily. Because, even though the times are this harsh, there are still such people, and it is for their sake that heaven holds back, and this filthy world still keeps going. There are people who, when they see a young man, a girl, a gentleman I know here, a mother, possessed, and see that the people around them are unbelievers, and so on, of their own free will, on their own, they keep a 40-day fast. They fast for that unnamed person they pity. So if these people present themselves before the saint up there, there you will hear from the demon what it says about those who fast for such a case. And then you will understand the all-conquering power of fasting. Then you will understand, as a mere man, the all-conquering power of fasting. He comes to him not while he is fasting, he says, but while he is hungry, so that you may learn what a great good fasting is, and how it is a mighty weapon against the devil, and that after the washing, that is, after baptism, one should not multiply luxury and drunkenness and laden tables and so on. That is, after baptism, when you become a Christian, you are to turn away from all of it, the feasting and the rest. You will have to struggle. Of course, what I am telling you now is advanced mathematics, and perhaps you don't grasp it. I take this chance to tell you, we were baptized as infants. We understood nothing of these things. We were never catechized. Our godmother may have brought us patent leather shoes, but she never spoke to us about renouncing Satan and being joined to Christ. She never told us this. We simply do not know this thing. Well and good, since we ran our course like the flu, because for the flu there is no medicine, the doctor says. It will simply run its course. So it was with our youth, how much we denied Christ and tore down everything sacred and holy. Whatever came our way, then in some fashion we turned back, and here we now find ourselves. So here we are now called to sit an examination, both for what we tore down and for what we ought to have kept standing. And the struggle is somewhat hard, not impossible, bearable. Things are, of course, tight. And here he stops now and says, "You must learn that after the washing, after baptism, and for us it is after the re-baptism, after our metanoia, repentance, after our own second baptism, when we returned. Not luxury, feasting," he says, "and drunkenness and laden tables, fuller tables and so on. No, but take heed to fasting. You must live with self-control, with temperance, with watchfulness. For this very reason Christ himself also fasted. He had no need to fast, not that he himself needed it. He had no need of fasting. He left it as an example for us, leaving us a pattern, that we might walk in his footsteps. Rather, it trains us, not that he himself needed it. For the sins that made the first washing necessary were born of the belly, he says. Sins that come quickly, the belly, he says, committed them. Had it not been so, we would have had need neither of baptism nor of confessions, but because of the belly of Adam these things came to pass as they did, so that if you would make a sick man well, he says, you must look to the very things from which the disease arose, and this is why he too, after the washing, took up fasting. Since you see, he says, that you fell ill from a certain occasion, now guard yourself against that occasion. So then, since you see that Adam, your father, was cast out because of his belly, you are obliged, if you are a rational person, as we were saying the day before yesterday concerning St. Anthony the Great, to avoid this very thing yourself. Since feasting, excess, laxity, and the rest cast people out of paradise, if you want to return within, you must do the exact opposite. This is what this Holy Father says. For the intemperance of the belly cast Adam too out of paradise, and this same belly, this feasting, brought about the waters of the flood in the days of Noah. He makes a distinction, because some of us, the cunning ones, will say, but those people were cast out because of sodomy, because of fornication. Notice how he forestalls it. Do not be hasty. He says here, this same belly brought about the flood upon those men, and it brought down the thunderbolts upon Sodom. For the sin of Sodom was fornication. It was fornication, a sin. Yet the root of both punishments sprang from here, from the belly. He says this too. Feasting and the rest is the very thing that turns a man aside into the sins of the flesh. For this reason, he too fasts 40 days, showing us the medicines of salvation, showing us the medicines by which we can be saved. And then the enemy draws near, using a stratagem and ambiguous, double-edged words. And just as, approaching Adam at the beginning, he set forth by deceit the things that were not. Here, you see, he brings the man back again to how Satan operated. He says, what is going on here? What is this Satan doing? He says, notice what he did there, where he went to draw out how God had spoken, so as to set his trap. And he said there, did God really tell you not to eat from anything? And she poured out her heart and said, we may eat of everything except this one. Ah, he seizes on it. Ah, I know why. He does not want you to become gods. See how he leads her into deep water. He does the very same thing here too, he says. To you it may seem strange, but it is the same Satan. And just as, approaching Adam at the beginning, he invented things about God that were not true. This is his whole business, his cunning. And now he searches to find and set a trap to seize man once again. There is more, we said. This is only one part that flows out of this temptation of our Lord. God willing, as I told you, I will say something further next time to complete it, and if need be, we will hold even a third lesson, so that I may convey the wonder of what God has fashioned here, and whether we ourselves know these things, for he will ask us about them one day.